Hi, so glad to be here. It's so very exciting to be able to share from my point of view about the work that we do in the state of Tennessee and on a national level as well. And I also have no disclosures. And so, yes, we do. We are the only reproductive justice organization in the state of Tennessee currently. I think that that's really important with the understanding that we're also the only women of color-led organization that does this type of work on behalf of our communities in particular. So I think that it's really important, since we're talking about reproductive justice, for there to be an understanding of what the framework is. I don't want to assume that folks understand what reproductive justice is. And so here is a basic definition that reproductive justice, or RJ, as we call it for short, basically means that that every woman has that right to decide if and when she's going to have a baby, if she doesn't want to have a baby, and then she needs to be supported with the necessary social supports to have the children, to be supported with the children that she already has, in healthy communities without fear of violence from individuals or the government. So I think that that's really important to just make sure that it is a human right, and what we support in the lens and space in which we do our work in the state of Tennessee. And then, let me go back. So many activists have worked on the issue of abortion or privacy as if those issues alone define the scope of women's reproductive health issues, without addressing that right to have children, the right to parent, and or the broader effects stemming from the lack of access and education regarding these choices and others. So RJ connects those reproductive health and rights issues to other concerns such as racism, economic justice, environmental justice, LGBTQ oppression, domestic violence, sexual assault, all of these kind of myriad of issues. And then using this human rights lens allows the development of new ways of thinking, strategizing, organizing, and in this case, service delivery, which bridges the respect and promotes the leadership and experiences of and visions of women and girls of color, poor women and their families. And then we define reproductive justice in a sexual rights U.S. context, including the rights of all people, and then define that common problem as reproductive oppression, meaning the control and exploitation of women, girls, and individuals through our bodies, sexuality, labor, and reproductive justice, reproduction, in order to develop a more inclusive and catalytic vision on how to move forward. And so we do that through thinking about our work intersectionally. So intersectionality is the space in which we do our work, which is the study of intersections between forms or systems of oppression, domination, or discrimination. And so women of color apply this study of thinking in reproductive justice to highlight the intersections of reproductive oppressions that marginalize women who are disproportionately women and girls of color face on a daily basis, which impede their abilities to be self-determining. And so we have Kimberly Crenshaw, whose piece Mapping the Margins, where she talks about intersectionality, identity politics, and violence against women of color, is where she highlights those multiple oppressions that African-American women face in particular. So it challenges the single issue organizing. So for us, it's not just about reproductive rights. It's not just about access, because in the work that we do, the women we serve don't necessarily have access. So we want to make sure that we meet that woman where she is, and we begin with her lived experiences as a space and way that we do and frame how we need to service women, or how we need to think about service provision, policy, and even advocacy. So it's important, I think, and we've heard some really great information about kind of what it looks like to do, what it looks like for women who are seeking health care in the South and throughout the country. But I want to give you a little bit more information about the political climate in the state of Tennessee. And so first, we are supermajority Republicans. We have, several legislation, we've been in, constantly in the fire right now because Amendment 1 just passed, basically taking that privacy provision out of the Tennessee State Constitution, which would make abortion legal under rape, incest, or danger of the mother's life is now currently out of the Tennessee state constitution. And conservative legislation disproportionately affects marginalized communities, and most of all, as these communities present the least amount of resources to access contraceptive methods and have limited health care options. Since many of Tennessee's legislators are religious, legislation suggests that women's decision-making is inherently flawed and often unintentionally complicit with forces that seek to destroy our families. It also implies that women cannot be trusted to make decisions for themselves and that in their families without guidance from male-dominated perspectives on justice. Currently, there's a pending bill being presented now that Amendment 1 has passed by one of Tennessee's male Republican legislators, which would mandate that women seeking abortions would have to view and or hear their ultrasound 24 to 72 hours before a procedure. And if she refuses that portion, it's then the responsibility of the provider to describe to her the contents of her ultrasound. So despite the consideration on the emotional or even the mental impact this could have on a victim of sexual assault, for example, or on a young woman who may already be terrified that she's having a procedure in the first place, the intent is to sway women into not having abortions, and yet these same legislators will not support that same woman or girl to have the education to learn about ways to avoid a pregnancy. So some of the conservative legislation that I wanted to highlight in my presentation is the abstinence-only sex education bill, which I think reflects in our first speaker, Dr. Kimball, basically spoke about the fact that sex education, there was the lack of sex education in southern states and evangelical states. The fetal assault law, which passed this past July, which would criminalize mothers who were using drugs at the time of pregnancy. If their babies presented as having any type of opiates in their system, and then the anti-abortion legislation that just currently passed. So we did a recent focus group with teens, parents, and teachers who live and work in communities of color throughout Memphis. And I'm going to address kind of the what came out of the sex education piece for us, because that's a huge piece of our work, one that I really feel that possibly needs to be maybe what we need to be focusing on in trying to influence voters to think about abortion a little bit more broadly. If folks don't understand their bodies, then we really cannot expect them to be able to avoid abortions, to be quite honest. So the goal of the focus groups was to hear directly from youth who were most affected and their parents about the need for comprehensive reproductive and sexual health education, and then to also allow teachers who spend a significant portion of the day with those young people to weigh in on what they saw behaviorally among their students. All parties echo the dire need for not only comp sex ed among teens, but that parents also needed it as well. Teachers also felt it was necessary that comprehensive sex ed be a standalone class so that students would have more time to learn and apply the education to their daily lives. The way that we have it currently, young people get about 6 classes in a full school year about sex education. And unfortunately, because it's looked at as gateway information to support them having sex, they're only able to get information about how not to get, about abstinence and not about using contraceptives, nothing about it's heteronormative, it doesn't necessarily have any education or information for young people who present as LGBTQI. I think that's really important, you know, when we're of who's framing the way that our children learn and how they're framing it and how that's unfair to all young people. So some of the statistics that came out of what we found in the focus groups is that 90% of the teens we surveyed felt uncomfortable going to their parents to have conversations about sex and contraception. Over 80% of the teens expressed that if they could not get the barrier method, like just condoms or female condoms, they would go ahead and have unprotected sex anyway. And so in communities of color, low-income communities in particular, condoms are locked up. There are no female condoms in many. Before I did work in Tennessee, I did the same work in Chicago. And it's the same thing in both places. In lower-income neighborhoods, there may not be female condoms, or regular condoms might be. Male condoms may be locked up, for example. So over 70% of the parents were not comfortable or knowledgeable about their own sexual health. And so I think that this kind of debunks this whole piece of putting sex education back in the hands of the parents, that legislators would lead us to believe that they care when young people's parents don't understand their own bodies. And so a lot of times when I talk to parents, you know, I'll start off by saying, how many of you planned the children that you had? And more than not, they say, I mean, none of them, right? So we're having children, but we're not taking the time to plan the children. And so teachers offered their assessment of teens' daily behavior and conversation in school and stated that teens were more curious to try out different sexual scenarios beyond heterosexual sex and therefore needed more education and guidance in figuring out their sexuality. So abstinence-only sex education, as I'm sure that we know in this room, does not work. But, you know, for whatever reason, there's a space of disconnect. And for me, it is founded in this kind of moral, conservative, evangelical space, as opposed to what the CDC standards even say. So I wanted to, because I'm an advocate and I'm an activist, you know, I want to give you guys some opportunities to think about how you can advocate for your patients and go even more up a step further than what you're already doing. And so maybe intentional attempts to strengthen the patient-provider trust. Making patients aware of their rights, for example, I think is a good idea. Patient-to-physician sharing circles, group follow-up. I know one of our clinics in Memphis does group follow-up as an option for post-abortion care, and a lot of times it is in these spaces where women are able to kind of share about other issues that are going on in their lives, like domestic violence or homelessness, poverty, because I think that, you know, there just aren't enough guards at the door to kind of understand what women's lived experiences are from day to day. It's not just that we don't give a damn about, you know, whether or not we want to bring children into the world. I think that, you know, the conditions in which we're expected to live and thrive and survive are being ignored. So in thinking about the accountability piece, even around pregnancy criminalization, while it may be easier to blame women for opiate use, it is imperative that the medical community's role in the increase of opiate usage be addressed and even monitored. The inherent power inequities between physician and patients must also be examined, which in some cases perpetuate a lack of communications between patients and their physicians. And so that's not to demonize the medical community, but that is to say that there needs to be some level of checks and balances so that women don't get the full brunt or the responsibility laid at their feet for using drugs when in all actuality, it could be a situation where it all began as a toothache. And next thing she's an addict now, right? So I think that, you know, it's not really, really fair. And so maybe some of those inherent power inequities need to be addressed in our society's institutions. And expanding services in a non-shaming and non-stigmatizing manner, creating more health data. I think that, you know, it'd be a good idea for there to be more health data that is specific to communities of color, specific to those who live under the poverty level, so that we can make a better case even as activists on the ground, talking to legislators and our elected officials as well. So these are just some other things, right? And so let me show you some of the things that you've already done that I think is amazing, and I want to say thank you. The open letter from the National Advocates for Pregnant Women to the media and policymakers regarding that alarmist and accurate reporting on prescription opiate use by pregnant women. We were right in the thick of all of that, constantly correcting the media that babies weren't born addicted, but that they were born exposed to opiates. Talking about those long-term implications, trying to educate folks on what neonatal abstinence syndrome really is. And then even the open letter to the Tennessee Medical Association, which for us was kind of the nail in the coffin when our governor signed the pregnancy criminalization or fetal assault law bill into law. Once the Tennessee Medical Association stood with, you know, politicians, then I feel like our governor felt justified in passing the law, which for the first baby who was born to a woman in Memphis, caused her to leave that baby at the hospital and was on the run for 21 days because she didn't want to be arrested, right? And she would not come out of hiding until she had a lawyer. And so what I know, because I've had opportunity to speak with her, is that, you know, she was put into a 28-day a program, which was a rehabilitation. It really was detox. And then she was sent to a kind of halfway house type situation in a community which really doesn't support her to not use drugs anymore, and expected to do well, right? So, you know, so it's really not about families the way that the South touts, and especially the conservative evangelical piece. It seems to be more about babies and not necessarily even thinking about the full family. And so these are just some of our medical allies, medical community allies, including the American Public Health Association, who stood with Tennessee, who stood with us. And so even after all of these amazing folks, right, our governor still signed this bill into law, which for me, you know, and I hope for you, really shows that this really isn't about people's health and lives. This is really about a political agenda. This is from a space or some type of moral position, as if the moral position trumps medical expertise. And I think that is worth speaking on. So I do thank you to let you know that there is collective work going on throughout the country, and we really do need this cross-section of support to continue in order to push back against these harmful policies which aren't founded in medical science. And I want to ask you to take your advocacy a step further and apply this human rights lens. Really think about reproductive justice and apply it to ensure that women, girls, and our families have every opportunity to lead the healthiest lives possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sharif. I want to invite the audience to start with a couple of clarifying questions for Sharif, as we've done with each of the speakers, and then we can broaden it out into a bigger discussion, because all these great presentations, you know, lead us towards how do we respond to make this better. Just call out, introduce yourself when you speak.
Yes, that Tennessee law, and actually there really isn't proper treatment for women who use methadone, right? And so those women are also losing their children as well. Mm-hmm. The first woman who was arrested was in East Tennessee, and she was a methadone user. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just so that we understand what the disparities look like in income, her bail was $2,000. She couldn't make the $200 and sat in jail for 10 days. Right. So 10 days of them not telling you what's happening to this woman while she's coming down and not being treated. So I think that's really important for us to be thinking about as advocates and as the medical community.
Is there another clarifying question? Yeah.
Yeah, I think we kind of were running into the same thing, and one thing that we tried to continue to push forward was the family, right, and really looking at what this type of legislation would do to poor women who could not navigate the court system or didn't have the means to do so. Because the other piece that, you know, once it translates on the ground, is once you take babies away from poor women who cannot afford a lawyer to get them back, they lose their kids. And so for us, that was far more of a punitive measure than even going to jail, right? So I think that it's really important, and a lot of times for us, you know, the coalition that I'm a part of, Healthy and Free Tennessee, I think one of the reasons why Sister Reach wanted to kind of step out is because we could, without kind of an issue, talk about the impact on women of color, on poor women, where some of our white allies did not feel as comfortable to be able to make those distinctions. But I think that it's imperative that you do it anyway, because, right, and to really talk about the impact on poor women and families, what this type of legislation does in this type of situation.